This weekend starts right after this.
As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, this weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Vaping on campus. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. And here's what's coming up this hour.
College students living away from home for the first time are finding the buzz from vaporized substances irresistible despite bans on hundreds of campuses.
Want to be a better time manager in 2020? A leadership consultant explains how to be ruthless with your time at work and home.
A 7-year-old boy in Scotland made quick work of a metal detector he got for Christmas. Hear his shocking discovery on a beach.
And how confident are you in your ability to protect your iPhone? Americans are divided on whether to use a case.
People really care about their device, right? It's not something that you stick in a drawer and you see or touch like once or twice a week. We are literally tethered to these things. And so he and others said that they really care about the way that it looks, the way it feels, the way they can interact with it.
Daniela Hernandez of the Wall Street Journal on casing for your iPhone or no casing. Got a kid in college like me? Here's a story for you. With a growing health crisis that has killed more than 50 people and injured more than 2,500, Congress has passed a measure raising the smoking age to 21 for both tobacco and e-cigarettes. The FDA just announced it's banning fruit and mint-flavored vaping products. But the buzz from vaporized substances can prove irresistible for those living far from home for the first time, despite bans on vaping at more than 2,000 campuses nationwide. Here's an in-depth look from Dan Levin, national reporter at the New York Times, covering American youth. Dan, what are you hearing?
You know, there's been a lot of coverage about how high schools and parents are trying to crack down on vaping among teenagers. You're hearing, or at least we've read, about there are some high schools that are even doing nicotine testing among students. But what happens when those same teenagers graduate from high school and go up to college? Then you really have this kind of new phase in a young person's life, a lot of freedom, a lot of independence. But that same independence is really kind of paving the way for vaping addictions among a number, you know, a high number of college students. So I went to University of Georgia in Athens and, you know, saw exactly what was happening, which is you have kids who are vaping in class. You've got kids who are vaping in the dorms and not really facing any of the real consequences that would happen, you know, when they were at home.
Yeah.
And this is quite concerning, because the rates of vaping among college students, in fact, have doubled. According to a major study, you're seeing Juul being incredibly popular among teenagers and college students. And so the question for policymakers is, how do we deal with this, right? How do we stem this addiction before it really gets into, I think, even more of a crisis. And I don't think we really have the answers.
So you, at the University of Georgia, vaping is not allowed on campus, or I should say in class or in dorms, perhaps, and yet it's done in both places, correct?
Exactly. I mean, the thing about vaping is that it can be done surreptitiously. There's no odor.
Yeah.
It's not like cigarettes. So I spoke to students who exactly that's what they were doing. They were talking about how they vaped in class, under their shirts, in bars. I was in a bar and saw someone actually playing beer pong with a Juul hanging from his mouth that he was puffing on. And so these kind of bans, they don't really do much, I think, when it comes to vaping.
Yeah.
So, you know, the question is, how do policymakers, how do people proceed? And it's not really clear.
We're speaking with Dan Levin, national reporter at the New York Times, covering American youth. He's got an interesting piece entitled Vaping on Campus, No Parents, No Principals, A Big Problem. And it's kind of largely a look at kind of students managing their free time and freedom. figuring out what to do with it, in some cases filling that space with vaping. I thought there was an interesting anecdote you had in there about that one pot dealer you ran into. He said what sales are down and sometimes he's frowned upon, right?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. I mean, the sense among a lot of college students, and this seems to be based on the data, is that THC-related vaping products are really what's driving this health crisis in terms of lung injuries. And so while vaping nicotine doesn't seem to really be getting college students to not vape, the THC-related vaping products, I think, are now seen as dangerous. And so this was a dealer who last January got into that business. He would get the marijuana extract off the dark web, and that's what he was investing in. And so he was saying that now you have college students who are going back to kind of old school weed, right? Bongs, joints, things like that. And so that's hitting him financially, but also socially, that he has friends and other people on campus who are accusing him of harming people, who blame him for a lot of these problems. And of course he says, he told me, look, this is safe. I don't put any of those harmful additives into this oil. But yet he admitted that he really, because he buys it off the dark web, has no idea what's really in this marijuana extract.
Nice, Dan. Dan Levin, New York Times reporter covering American youth. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Ever look up and be shocked to see it's already 2 o'clock in the afternoon? Where did the day go? How will you ever get everything done? You just feel as there's not enough time in the day, but there is. You just have to be ruthless. So says Val Wright, leadership and innovation consultant, who's author of a book called Thoughtfully Ruthless, The Key to Exponential Growth. She spoke with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka about being ruthless with your time.
The word ruthless has negative connotations, but if you're thoughtful about it, that's when you can really take control of your life and simply create more time.
Do you apply this to your life professionally or personally?
Both, absolutely both. There is as many pulls and demands on your work life as your whole life, and you have to be laser focused and really intentional about every single activity, every single work project, and pay attention to exactly what you do and what you might get somebody else to do.
All right, Val, give us some examples.
Of course. So for those who work in small or larger companies, meetings are one of the greatest time sucks in the world. And I always say to people that it's very easy to reduce your meeting time by 75% because half of all meetings are not needed. They could have been communicated via an email, or there wasn't really anything much to communicate or discuss. And then of those meetings that are needed, you only need half of the people in the room. And there you create a 75% reduction in your meeting investment. And meetings have become the bamboo roots of attacking people's calendars in every country, in every business, and they kind of just take over when they really don't need to. You've got to really be ruthless about what you cut back and how you get your meetings back being productive and back being focused.
I think that many, many workers would agree with you, but perhaps not as many managers. How do you get them to turn that around?
You'd be surprised. You know, I speak at a lot of conferences and events, and when I ask that question about reducing your meetings by 75%, everybody nods. And I think people get stuck into habits and forget to really question, is this the right use of time? And, you know, I say to managers, you know, what would you do if, you know, your board or your CEO gave you an extra 20% of resources? And they immediately come up with all these incredible things and investments and ideas they have. And when you position it that way and then say to them, well, this is how you get more time back from your teams, I have found managers at all levels really do embrace this idea of a thoughtfully ruthless meeting that gives people back time.
We're speaking with Val Wright, leadership consultant and author. Val, how do you reduce distractions in your everyday life to save some time?
The first thing you have to do is really pay attention to the technology that you have. And, you know, as I'm sat here now, it will be very easy for my watch to be buzzing, for my phone to be giving me notifications, for my computer on my desk to be giving me notifications. And what you have to do is just stop and say, where are all these inputs? Because it's like the equivalent of when we used to sit in our office and only get a knock on the door or a mail envelope dropped in our mailbox. We allow digital knocks on the door of our attention all day long, all weekend long. And what we have to do is stop those knocks on the door. So you have to turn off your notifications. You have to not be sat in your inbox all day, every day. You know, if you're only checking your email 3 or 4 times a day and the rest of the time you switch it offline so you can actually create work and get work done rather than responding to work, that's another way that you can avoid the distractions and turning off all your notifications, deleting the apps on your phone that might be interesting but not helpful, particularly if you're on a deadline, and pay attention to the things that distract you and where you go when you get distracted, and eliminate those things because you have far more control and choice than you might realize with these distractions.
Val, you suggest that sometimes we need to kind of distance ourselves from our friends. How can we do that without hurting someone's feelings?
It's a controversial but essential reflection that everybody needs to make. And, you know, particularly, you know, when you think of our time being so precious, you have to ask yourself, when you're spending the weekend or you're spending an evening with someone, do they energize you and make you happy, or does that interaction fill you with dread? What you have to be able to do is just make choices and say, okay, I'm going to choose to spend more time with this person, and, you know, maybe I'm going to see this person less, or maybe I'm not going to see them again.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with leadership consultant Val Wright, author of Thoughtfully Ruthless, The Key to Exponential Growth. 21 minutes after the hour. Thanks for being with us with the new year here. How about a handful of tech resolutions? Jefferson Graham, personal technology columnist at USA Today, has some tips on how to take hold of your digital life in 2020. Jeff, start with passwords.
Well, first of all the hacker needs is one password to get in, and that's it. And most people, unfortunately, have the same password at every website. So it sounds horrible, but you need a different password for everywhere you go. Just to protect yourself, if you want to get hacked, go keep on doing 123 or password, that's fine. But you need to change your passwords, different password every website, and then you say, well, I can't remember them, so you subscribe to a password manager, which automatically inputs them for you when you go to these sites. And then you have to remember one master password at the password manager.
Because they're all encrypted, right? So if you use like a Dashlane or LastPass, do you enter all your current passwords into that? Is that how it works? And then,
well, when you set it up,
yeah,
you do that, but then you never have to type the password again,
right?
once you've done the setup.
Yeah.
So for instance, you don't want to use public Wi-Fi at a hotel or an airport because somebody can hack into you. Which means, oh, well, I can't buy anything on Amazon. I can't book an airline ticket. Well, you actually can. You can use their Wi-Fi with your password manager because you're not actually typing in the information to Hotwired or to Amazon. It's just going through without you typing in the digits, so there's no way for the hacker to get them.
Mm-hmm. I like one of your suggestions, too, here about videotaping interviews with loved ones. That's not one that normally comes up on some of these, you know, digital to-do lists in the new year. Why'd you bring this one up?
I'm real big on it because my late father, I spent the last day of his life interviewing him. Finally, he finally agreed to do it. And I drove away, and then to everyone's surprise, he died the next day. So, I've got that hour. And I can play it back, and it goes beyond memories. But that is just the easiest thing in the world to do to preserve memories. Everybody has the phone in their pocket. Everyone has an amazing camera, and a $10 tripod attachment, and you're there.
Yeah,
that's all you need.
Not to probe too much. Did you ask like deep questions or like funny stuff, or did you do a mix? What'd you do with them?
It was part one of what I thought was going to be a 10-parter.
Oh.
So it was just on his early career.
Wow. That's fascinating. We're speaking with Jeff Graham, personal technology columnist at USA Today, also host of a podcast called Talking Tech. And he's written a piece
entitled Your 2020 Checklist, 6 Steps to a Safer Digital Life. What did you put together with regards to subscriptions?
Well, you know, we all have more and more subscriptions because that's how internet companies make money. And most of us forget what we're subscribing to, and we don't even know what we're subscribing to. So I would recommend making a list, figuring out if you're actually looking or using any of these services. You check your credit card bills as well. It's a great way to find out who's dinging you. And then start weeding it out. For instance, I subscribe to Disney Plus on the first day to find out if I could actually get it because so many people were having problems. And as good as Disney Plus is, I haven't looked at it since. Mm. There are other people who are probably looking at it all the time, but for whatever reason, I'm not looking at it. So there's no reason for me to pay $7 a month for this until I'm ready to start looking.
Why clear out your phone apps?
They're really huge. Most people don't. They weren't that big in the beginning, but they have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. Many people listening to your show right now have phones that only have 16 gigabytes of memory because that's what they used to have. The newer phones have 60. They start at 64. But with a 16 gigabyte phone, your operating system is half of it. You're taking high resolution photos and videos. That's eating up your space. And then the apps, Facebook could be a gigabyte. TikTok could be a half a gigabyte. Go to the general settings and look at what you're using and then decide, well, why do I have this app here in the first place if, again, like subscriptions, if I'm not using it? Let's get rid of it.
Thanks, Jeff. Jefferson Graham, personal technology columnist at USA Today. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppes, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show. Like us on Facebook or send us an email. This Morning at CompassMediaNetworks.com.
Thanks for spending time with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka coming up this half hour. Are you starting a new job in 2020? If so, you need to be aware of the new W-4 form. Also, Americans divided on whether or not to use protective casing for their iPhones, and the shocking discovery by the boy who received a metal detector for Christmas. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Police departments across the country are adding training so officers can tell that a dog with perked up ears and a wagging tail might not be all that friendly and know how to calm even an aggressive animal. Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Kessling spoke with This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
The Department of Justice just officially published a handbook. It's called the Toolkit for Law Enforcement Dog Encounters. And that comes after a push from some private organizations and the National Sheriff's Association, to have police get out ahead of training to deal with encountering dogs, because there's been a recent spate of lawsuits, high profile social media accounts where law enforcement officials and departments catch a lot of flack when a dog is shot, even if police are justified in shooting it. So police are trying to get ahead of that curve and teach their departments how to de-escalate those situations.
What are some of the ways they can de-escalate such a situation?
Well, at the very root of it all is to just change the mindset with police and dealing with dogs, to see them as not just an obstacle in the way of maybe getting to a suspect or dealing with an issue, but seeing those dogs as, you know, potentially part of a family, right? Like, they're a lot of times seen as being another kid in a family instead of a piece of property. So changing that mindset is the number one thing, but also some basic things like teaching police how to read dog body language and how to use verbal commands to de-escalate situations. And then if things do get out of control, use things like pepper spray to incapacitate a dog rather than shooting it.
We're speaking with Ben Kessling of the Wall Street Journal. Ben, how much has public outrage and or social media contributed to this movement?
It's contributed quite a bit. And it's mostly just there's a way that these police departments can kind of avoid all of this, a lot of bad publicity and potential very high dollar civil lawsuits by just being prepared to deal with dogs ahead of time, talking to law enforcement associations and individual sheriffs and police officers, police chiefs around the country. I found that a lot of times these departments have to experience firsthand what happens when a dog is shot and it becomes a news item or goes into a court case before police get ahead of the curve and start training on this.
Ben, did you get any feeling or reading on whether police want this kind of training, how they are accepting it?
So a lot of departments really do want the training. And the thing is, the training can just be, a lot of times, added into pre-existing programs. So many departments across the country now have essentially glorified virtual reality training. So you have like a room with a bunch of screens. An officer stands in the middle of those screens, and you have scenarios that go by, escalation of force procedures, etc. Now there's these dog programs that can be put in there. So when a police officer goes in for this virtual reality training and they're serving a warrant or something, now the departments can add in an angry animal that they have to deal with during the process. And it's something that police face regularly when they're serving these things. And speaking with police chiefs and sheriffs who had implemented this, it's not that other departments are resistant to the training, it's just that they might not understand the utility of it yet.
Thanks, Ben. It's Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Kessling with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. Thanks for spending time with us. The new year launches fresh starts, resolutions, and in the case of the IRS, new tax paperwork. Beginning now, there's a whole new look for the W-4 form about taxes to be withheld from your pay. More from Andrew Keschner, reporter at MarketWatch. Andy set this up.
The W-4, for starters, is that piece of paper that your employer will make you fill out, likely on your first day of work, saying how much money you want to hold back in federal taxes. And what is happening here is after the new tax code went into effect, it took a couple years, but they're finally getting around to updating this W-4 so it helps taxpayers say how much they want to withhold in taxes.
All right, so this is only relevant if you're actually starting a new job in 2020, not if you're in the same job that you were at the end of 2019, for example.
That's right. If you are at a job right now and you are fine with how much money you are holding back in your paycheck right now, you don't have to do a thing. But if you are starting a new job in 2020, this is going to be the piece of paper or the electronic form that you're going to have to fill out going forward.
It does seem like from reading your story, there are significant mistakes that you could make or mistakes that could lead to significant consequences. I'm not sure that was necessarily the case under the old form.
Yeah, what's happening here is, first off, if we all remember the old form, it had these things like the number of allowances and it was, you know, numbers. And this is working in dollars. And so the hope there is to make it a little bit more, you know, real life practical for the people who are filling it out. But you're right, there are some ways that you could be holding back way too much money and then get hit with a tax bill come April, which no one wants. One thing to do is, if you're married, and let's say you're married and you're starting a new job, but your spouse is at their old job, you're going to fill out your form and you're going to make a withholding. You've got to make sure that your spouse does the same thing too and indicates that they are also employed, because if not, they might be holding back too much. Even though you're holding back enough, they might be holding back too much, and that could lead to a tax bill. at the end of the tax season.
We're speaking with Andrew Keschner, MarketWatch reporter, talking about the new W-4 form. What else to keep in mind here?
Well, one thing is they're going to, again, because they're talking in how much money you want to hold back, the new form is getting at questions of how much money is coming into your house to begin with. There's a portion of it where it's asking about all of the income that's coming into your house. And let's say you're a single person and you have this new job, but you also happen to have a job on the side. Maybe you have a side hustle as an Uber driver or something like that. But you think your new employer might be not so thrilled to know that you're working a lot of hours beyond what they are asking of you. There are ways to not disclose that and just go straight to say, this is the amount of money I want withheld overall.
Thanks, Andrew. Andrew Keschner, reporter at MarketWatch. It is 14 minutes now in front of the hour. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. As smartphones balloon in price, some pushing past $1,000, there's a debate between case haves and case have nots. One side says it makes sense or makes absolutely no sense to ferry such expensive gadgets unprotected, especially one vital to modern living. Phone case holdouts say cases cause carelessness, leading to phones dropped. It's a story by Daniela Hernandez, digital science editor at the Wall Street Journal. Daniela, what did you put together?
Yeah, so I mean, the story came about because I was being made fun of by some friends for not having a case of my own, and I was looking to do a funny, lighthearted story for the end of the year. And as I was on the train, I looked down at my phone and saw once again that I didn't have a case, and I thought, there must be other people like me who decide to go caseless. And so I started talking to friends and reaching out to people on social media and talking to coworkers. And I was able to find some pretty interesting characters, like the two graduate students at the top of the story. They have a bet going on about who's going to break their phone first. One has it naked, and the other one is in this huge, military-style grade case, what he says is the beefiest case money can buy. And so the holdouts, the people who don't have cases on them, say that, they're more mindful, they're more careful with their very expensive, very precious devices because they aren't covered, and so they could be injured at any time. And they make the case that the people who do have them in cases are a little less careful than they should be.
We're speaking with Daniela Hernandez, digital science editor at the Wall Street Journal. She's written a piece entitled, Do You Protect Your iPhone? It's a case study that divides Americans. Did it strike you? I'm not asking you for some scientific research here, but just based on your handful of anecdotes, did it seem to break down by age or gender or line of work as to who has a case and who does not for their phone, for their iPhone?
No. I think, men and women I spoke to were both on the cased and the uncased side. the insurance company that I spoke with, SquareTrade, said that, there are three kinds of people. They're the people who are adamant caseless users. There are people who always have their phone in a case. And then there's the third group that has it in a case intermittently. So sometimes it's in a case, sometimes it's not, depending on circumstance. Personality types and ages and gender and all these other demographics break down within those three categories, that's TBD. Maybe scientists will find out one day.
Wow. Wow. How about that public health professor from Harvard who said he spends months thinking about this?
Yes, people really care about their device, right? It's not something that you stick in a drawer and you see or touch once or twice a week. We are literally tethered to these things. And so he and others said that they really care about the way that it looks, the way it feels, the way they can interact with it. And a case is a big part of that. And so because these devices are so personal, such a big part of our lives, it would make sense that you would care about, what it's encased in, and how you are going to go about, touching it and interacting with it.
Thanks, Daniela. Daniela Hernandez, digital science editor at the Wall Street Journal. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, what a young boy discovered with the brand new metal detector he got for Christmas.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Lyles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. How about stumbling onto something like this? A 7-year-old boy in Scotland discovered the remains of a World War II grenade on a beach in the Scottish Highlands, courtesy of the metal detector that he got for Christmas. The British news agency, SWNS, says Patrick McAlinden made his discovery just 15 minutes after arriving on the beach at Loch Morlock to play with his new present while on vacation with his family. He said the metal detector almost went off the scale. He thought it was gold or maybe something else. In addition to the grenade remains, he found discarded crates and a bomb warning sign believed to be where Allied Norwegian soldiers trained. Upon finding the historic items, the family called police and were put in touch with bomb disposal experts. After they were told there was no risk to them, the McAlinden family kept sweeping the beach, even as the dig attracted hordes of onlookers. His mom says that Patrick is looking forward to making more discoveries and is eager next to find gold. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.